Generally, I like to start with a ballad. So, The Willowed Grove. This is a result of a dream I had. One day I was cutting timber down Sally Timber, down by the river, and I fell asleep. And I dreamt this. And when I woke up, I just dozed off. When I woke up, I wrote it down. I went down to the willowed grove where the river troubles itself with stones and met a woman made of shadow, making herself a coat of thorns. Why do you clothe yourself in thorns, O strange young woman of the darker skin, so that no man can touch my flesh, only birds and insects enter in? O pretty young girl, you're as dark as space, but your beauty outshines every star. Undress yourself of your thorny coat, and I'll be your lover without a care. You can't love me, you mortal man, for I am ancient as the sea. I was unborn before you were made, and no man's love am I meant to be. Oh, I went down to the willowed grove, where the river troubles itself with stones, and met a woman made of shadow, making herself a coat of thorns. Despite the Sassenach accent, I'm actually a Kerry man. I was born in the small Irish Republic of my mummy's womb, but through no fault of my own, she was in London at the time, so that's where I slipped out. I spent a lot of my childhood between two places in the summer. My father's place in Temple Plantin in Limerick, and my mummy's place just over the Limerick Kerry border in Slieve Lucre in Brosnan. This poem is an elegy. It's for my granddad, my mother's father, my granddad Curtin. My granddad has Lama Tenzing. Lama Tenzing stops at the river and grasps his chest. His disciples panic, fuss around him, but already his chest has opened. Sparrows are exiting from the wound, 25 sparrows in all. The disciples count each single one, and every one of them made of smoke as they swoop down into the grass are absorbed by the earth. Lama Tenzing, 25 sparrows, journeys through the bursting heart of the world, comes out through a wound in the yard where my grandfather stands by the spigot. Oh, granda, you grasped your chest and 25 sparrows flew out, but no one saw them, for they were made of smoke. I'm only 12, granda, and too far away. I cannot hold you as you fall. I know only that the sparrows fly over the yard, over the galvanized roof of the shed. The fjorkadorns are ripening in the field, their spoked seeds floating up. Each becomes the heart of a sparrow, and all is healed. Another childhood poem, but this one now from my London childhood. In the near distance, rising high above the sweet factory, was a tall brick chimney, as tall as any of the blocks of flats to the east. At the very top of the chimney was the word Maynards. The only thing that Maynards made, as far as we knew, were wine gums, but we couldn't work out what the chimney had to do with slugs. Thick white smoke would pour out of it during the day, smoke so heavy that it had trouble rising into the air and would usually just accumulate into a bulbous cloud beside the chimney mouth. From the school playground during afternoon sports, we'd often see it and wonder. A sickly smell like a burnt treacle would waft through the streets around the school. It'd enter classroom windows and hang over the desks. Once or twice after school, we took a trek to the factory, but soon gave it up when we realized that there were no sweets paving the road outside the gate. A tall brick wall topped with rusting spikes surrounded the factory. The whole place looked sinister and gave every kid in the school the creeps. I often wondered what made that thick smoke. Imagined that black coal, sticky with bitumen, was an ingredient of the sweets, and never developed a taste for wine gums until well into my adult years. But oftentimes in winter, when the fog would bind the factory smoke, we'd stand in the playground in the leaden mist, the sky fallen into our lives, and breathe the waste fumes of the sweet factory, our young tongues acrid, our minds opening up to the dullness of the world. I know you're going to get tired of clapping now, and this is a good time for me to tell you not to clap after every poem, because then when you stop clapping, I won't really, I'll be able to fool myself that it isn't because my poetry has suddenly turned into crap. Of course, if you want to clap, you can. But if you don't, I know it's because I told you not to.
It could be that your poetry is crap.
Be quiet, you.
I will go.
You could be right. Night. The thin moon squeezes its light into the darkness of the garden. Limp blades of Montbretia grass dream of the burning flowers that are yet to come. On the gravelled path, snails expand from the muted trumpet of their shells. Earwigs unbed themselves from the tight petals of a rose. Flies enter the purple vaginas of digitalis. But she is aware of none of this, does not know the names of the flowers, cannot guess at the urgency of insects, or indeed that they are urgent. As she cowers on the wardrobe floor, her feet half out of the opened door, her father's drunken kiss still on her tongue. This is another poem from my Brusner childhood. I suppose my dad's family gets kind of left out because I never write about his family. They're very eccentric, but at the end of the day, compared to my mummy's family, they were kind of boring. I never say that to my father, though. I tell him it's because I haven't got round to writing about his side of the family yet. This is a poem about my mummy's brother, one of her many brothers. There was 14 in the family. They even count the one that dies only a day after being born. Of course you would, wouldn't you? This is about my Uncle Jack, and it's called Uncle Jack. Coming up the rutted drive to the yard with a roguish grin on his face, I knew he had something got for me. For one time, he'd got me a drum, a cowboy gun. Once he'd opened a furze bush to let loose linnets, finches, wrens, laughed as he'd lied he'd made them appear out of nothing. So here he was now, coming to the yard. I brought some money from the sea, he said, and pulled a stained, crumpled brown paper bag from out of his pocket and poured black snails the size of sixpences, dozens of them. He took a pin from his lapel and began to prick out the creature from the shell. The thing looked like snot coming from a tiny black nose. And then he put it to his mouth and ate it. I looked at him in wonder. Couldn't believe that my Uncle Jack had just eaten a snail, that looked like snot. Now, ye try it, he said. He'd never let me down. Had got me a drum, a cowboy gun, could magic up birds as quick as you please. So I did it. I let Uncle Jack put a pinprick of snail to my mouth, and I ate it. We sat in the yard and finished the bag. The Easter sky vibrant above our heads, the taste of the sea on our tongues. Sat in the yard like two sea princes stranded miles inland, our mouths rich with creatures of snot, the black empty shells of our fortune spent at our feet. Ooh. You see, I knew you'd clap again eventually. I like to write poems that are beautiful. You see, I think I can actually do it. I like to write beautiful poems about things that aren't beautiful, because things that aren't beautiful get kind of ignored. So this is a sonnet. I hope it's a beautiful sonnet. It's about shit. This first appeared in a journal called Revival, and I missed the launch of the journal. And the following day, I was in the stall, and a poet called Paddy Bush was sitting next to me, and he had a copy of Revival. And I said, "Oh, Jesus, Paddy, I've got a poem in that." He said, "Oh, have you?" I said, "I have." He said, "What's it about?" I said, "It's about shit." And he opened up the journal and he started to read it. Now, it's a sonnet, and if you observe the meter, a sonnet should take about a minute to read. And I timed him because there was a clock up in the wall. And he was looking at it for 2 minutes, so I kind of figured he'd read it twice. And I said, "Did you read it so badly?" And he said, "I did. I read it twice." And I said, "And what do you think of it, Paddy?" And he said, "Well, it's true for you, John W. It's complete shite." So here it is. The Enchanted Cowpat. It's also about drinking. I think drinking is slightly more beautiful than shit. I like to put two things in the poem, sometimes three or four. Especially when you're writing about something like shit, it's kind of good to put something else in there. So this is also about drink and being totally drunk. And let's not forget, it's also about shit. The Enchanted Cowpat. With his foot, he breaks a crusted cow cake, carries a secret over the moonlit meadow and up the carpet of the stairs unknowingly, prints out 60 steps of gleaming toe prints and kicks off his shoes straight under the bed, falls down onto the mattress fully clothed, the moon still on above the trees. He snores as the shit on the rug turns on its heel, retraces itself down the 60 steps, walks itself out from every blade of grass, a scuttery footrise, glinting silver, soft currency of green under moonbeams, back up the hill, each step of turd untrod, resurrected whole, while that fool still nods. I'm going to read a very serious poem now about something very serious. It's about how things go wrong. By the way, thank you, Paul, for asking me to read. Paul contacted me very late last night and he said that Alan Garvey couldn't make it, and he asked me if I would read. And I needed to juggle a few things, so I wasn't sure if I'd make it. So I said, Paul, if you don't mind, I'll be able to confirm in the morning. So he said, that's fine. So anyway, eventually I went to bed and I fell asleep. And this morning, I had this dream that I was at poetry reading. I was at poetry reading, and it was a reading and a workshop. And whatever it was, any time I went to read a poem, I couldn't see it. I couldn't see it on the page. And then I tried to read it from memory, and I couldn't bloody remember it. And I introduced about 5 poems, and I couldn't read a single one of them. And then something else started to happen. I was thinking, oh, I've got to get hold of this. And I'm going to look for the poem that I decided to read next. And it was gone. And I had 2 books that I was going to read from, and I turned around and they were gone. I thought, Jesus, this is bad. And this was going on forever, and I was introducing poems by their titles, and I couldn't read a single one of them. And then I had 2 books left, and I thought, oh Jesus, I'm gonna hang on to these books now so I don't lose them, and I put them right in front of me. I thought, I'm going to pick them up now, they're not going to go anywhere. And I introduced the poem, and looked down, the books were gone. And I woke up from that dream, let me tell you, it was a fucking nightmare. And I woke up from that dream and I thought to myself, fuck it, that's it, I'm definitely reading in Unveil tonight. I took it as a sign. Things go wrong. Sometimes things are never right in the first place. Things are not right in the kingdom. The jester's overcoat refuses to leave the wardrobe, and his shoes, impatient as always, have gone on ahead. Beneath the cankerous apple tree, the knave of knives sharpens a spoon. As a sovereign rolls beneath the floorboards, the court mathematician discovers the concept of negative numbers. As the queen draws the comb through her long hair, she thinks of dipping spoons into her husband's body. In the kitchen, 5 and 20 mice have hidden in a cake, waiting for the cat to leave the house. Still in his bed, asleep, the king dreams that he's a playing card. Someone is holding him in their grubby fingers. In the counting house, all the money deludes itself that it will never be spent. The maid is in the garden, hanging out the clothes. She wipes the queen's knickers against her nose. I don't know. You devote your life to poetry and people clap at something like that. Must be good though. Put it in the water. Six faces and a woman of nothing. Six faces is asleep in the grass. All of his eyes closed at once. He has been asleep for so long that the grasses have begun to take root in his mind. 2 lovers enter one of his mouths and begin to couple on his tongue. Bats have entered at his 12 ears, their excrement layered night after night. Six faces is dreaming 6 times over, 6 different dreams. His 6-sided brain is throbbing with thought, but he'll remember not one single thing. A woman of nothing finds him lying asleep. She has never seen anything so curious before. A wheel of six spaces. She would lift it, but she has no hands. Gently tow it over the grass, but she has no feet. She'd kiss the six mouths one by one, but she has no mouth of her own. House martins emerge from his 12 nostrils, catch insects in flight, and then return. Bees have built their hives in the ducts at the corners of his eyes. How beautiful he is, fast asleep. Wild pigs emerge from one of his mouths, go rooting amongst the trees. Monkeys scramble up the lines of his foreheads, disappear into his thick hair. Wake up, thinks the woman of nothing, but her thoughts are soundless. She lies down beside him, begins to doze. Soon she is asleep, a nothing head dreaming of nothing. She becomes the space that he'll see if he wakes. I like writing about nature and animals. And the creatures in this poem are actually prevalent everywhere. I'd say most of you have one in your house. There's only one person in this room that doesn't have one in her house. And she is responsible for killing me fictionally earlier today. She refuses to have these things anywhere near her. And that's the thing with creatures. Some people are kind of finicky about them and don't like them. A concise natural history. Shy in their millions, the pipistrelle umbrellas fold themselves away in the vast underground wardrobes. Hang upside down by a single claw. Often mistaken for metaphors or mythological rainwear, their open plumage is widely considered unlucky if the sun is under 100 watts. When battered, will invariably display loosened bones and only capable of flight if turned inside out or shown sideways rein. Known to poke their beaks from those who hold them under arm while walking backwards in the busy street. Useless at golf, but useful for it. Black as a rule, and often domesticated, their inert shit is invisible and not recommended for attic insulation. Reputed to stray, and thus often found riding alone on city buses. How are we doing? You still awake?
Disappointed.
Well, that was a good answer. I don't know who said it though, because the person who I think said it looks so inscrutable, as if she'd never said a word ever. The Green Owl. I wanted to write this poem for a very, very long time. I wanted to write about this thing for a very long time. And you know yourselves, it's sometimes something just won't come. And then one day, I just found a way into it. The Green Owl. In class on Tuesday, she draws a picture for Mrs. Gray and gets 2 gold stars. It's a picture of a house inside the moon. Inside the chimney of the house is a badger, his snout pointing up. And inside the walls of the house are mice running up and down. and she's drawn herself inside a fishbowl with a single goldfish, and she's wearing a dress that's covered in ladybirds, and the goldfish is kissing her. She brings the picture home with her, and Mammy pins it up. She's in her bed now, looking at the picture through moonlight. Daddy's shouts move through the walls, tremble the carpet of her room. She gets out of bed and stands on the carpet to keep them down. Outside in the dark, an owl says who. With half its face bright in the tall sky, the moon's face is half black like Mammy's. Night by night, she's been watching the moon bruising in the tall sky. On Wednesday for Mrs. Gray, she makes a green owl from plasticine and gets 2 gold stars. The green owl has big goggles on, and its goggles catch and store moonlight, and moonbeams can come from its eyes. Night by night, she's going to watch the moon's face heal in the tall, bright sky. Watch the moon's face become white like Mammy's. On Thursday, she falls asleep in class, her head resting on her desk. She dreams of the green owl, and it carries her and Mammy to the moon. It's lashing wet as they fly through the sky, and a train shouts who through the driving rain, and they come to a house with mice in the walls, and the badger breathes smoke through the chimney, and Mammy puts her safely in a fishbowl, and a single goldfish kisses her, and Mrs. Gray gives her 2 gold stars. Well, 3 of you are awake anyway. Okay, I'm reading a really, really long poem now. I know you thought some of those are really long, but this is really, really long. This is destined to finish you off entirely. It's a sestina, so it definitely finish you off. Up and down in their sleep, or somebody's leaving, she couldn't take any more. You're not going as well, are you? Thank God. She's here all night. Did you hear the way she said that? Up and down in their sleep. One night, the snakes and ladder board woke up while the whole house slept. Ladders clattered down the stairs, set themselves up against walls, climbed to nowhere but themselves. Serpents entered through open doors, folded themselves neatly into cupboards. One coiled into the bath, filled it to the brim with its bulk. The bath tap dripped on the snake's head as it looked up at each descending drop. Then mice entered every room from behind the skirting, climbed up the tails of snakes, turned round, climbed back down. In their hundreds, mice assembled neatly on the backs of snakes, with sharp teeth neatly slit the skin from everyone. In the bath, the snake suddenly found his time was up. Likewise, every snake in the house entered the outside with its insides. Earwigs climbed from behind their dark spaces and looked down at the coils of red meat. Bright blood soaked down into the carpets across tiles, neatly filled a crimson pool, the enameled bath. Meanwhile, the grating of ladders woke up the youngest child. On tiptoe, he entered his parents' room, toes sticky with blood. Climbed into their bed and fell fast asleep. Climbed straight back into a dream where he fell down the back of a snake. 3 squares further up, a wooden ladder leant against the bath. Down at his feet, the number 5 neatly filled the square in which he stood. Mice entered the square and scurried up his legs, entered his pajamas, nibbled at his skin, climbed down his legs again. It slit his skin down from his head to his toes. It slipped neatly from his body. I'm a walking bloodbath, he thought to himself before waking up in his parents' bed. He sat up, entered day. Sunlight filtered down. Deep shadows climbed walls, neatly filled curtain folds, gaps above. I'm going to finish very soon now. Two poems, if I may. First one is it's a ballad, and it's I suppose it's a hymn as well. It's a hymn to my mother and father. I was born in 1958, so I'm 52, and I went to school in the 1960s and the early 70s. And my father was a typical paddy, really. He had the two main obsessions of men of his generation. And men of his generation were obsessed with their mothers and cement. So this is about those two obsessions, and I suppose it's about similar obsessions that I had as well. It's very simple. It's called For the Garden Path It Promised Her. For the garden path it promised her, my father bought 8 yards of sand. My mother watched the lorry pour its hissing load of brittle cloud, and all the neighbours gathered round and wondered what would come about. O kings of golden grit we were, as we played upon that yellow mound. For weeks it stood before the house, taking up the space of cars. Summer evenings it steamed with rain, changed its hues from brown to straw, filled our fingernails with grain and shaped our footprints on the floor. As it strayed throughout the house, Mum would gather it in the pan, take it back to its troubled heap where it would wander yet again. The wind would tempt it to the air with Jerusalems of other streets, but Mother brushed its drifting tides and tamed it to the roadside curb. The weekend came when Dad split bags of cement grey as graveyard stones, and in that day of burning sun, our mother watched a path begin. We made a lid for the kitchen yard, smothered thistles in their thoughts, and under Mother's silent guard, we laid a walkway through the lawn. That evening red as pots of jam, we bore our sunburnt backs to Mum, who soothed them cold with calamine and told us we were her best men. For the garden path it promised her, my father bought 8 yards of sand. Thank you, I'll finish now. Mantra of the Awoken Powers. In a copse of blackthorn, he cut a stave, then went beside my heart where I never went, then saw the place I was in that I never saw, then heard the songs I sang that I never heard, then said the words I spoke that I never said. And by a rocky shore, he trapped a fish, then came to the mind where I never came, then thought the thoughts I thought that I never thought, then made the promises I made that I never made, then broke the hearts I broke that I never broke, then kissed the lips I kissed that I never kissed. And in a bush of furs he caught a bird, then fell into the soul where I never fell, then killed a hope I killed that I never killed, then breathed the breath I breathed that I never breathed, then weaned the child I weaned that I never weaned, then lost the self I lost that I never lost. And in my hand I held a stave, and in my mouth I held a fish, and with my foot I held a bird, and I was alive though he was dead, and I moved though he was still, and I remain though he remaineth not.